All right. Good morning, everybody. 11:16, Wednesday, October 20th. We are back at Chem 12 lecture, and we are doing ethers and epoxides today. So that's where we're going to pick it up in looking at different reactions of ethers and epoxides. So this chapter is a rather small chapter. There's not a whole lot of reactions with the ethers in particular. We'll look at the formation of ethers rather than really the reactions of ethers. We get into epoxides. Epoxides have a little bit more that we can do with them. But let's take a look at some of these. Let me go ahead and start off. And let's see, screen share via cable. Okay, excellent. Ethers and epoxides. So looking at ethers and epoxides, we've got our ethers and we've got our epoxides. So really an epoxide is nothing more than a cyclic ether, not just a cyclic ether, I should say. It's really just a three ring cyclic ether. And so they're related in these two compounds in the way that we look at them. We'll do a little bit of nomenclature. We don't do a whole lot of nomenclatures with ethers or epoxides. By the way, epoxides are also known as oxiranes. Oh, except I gotta spell it. Oxo, I think it's oxorane. No, I gotta look it up. I've got it here someplace. Or maybe even I don't. I should just Google it. Why can I not do that? Oxirane, A-N-E. I'll look it up in a minute. We'll get back to it. Okay, nomenclature. So with nomenclature, we frequently do sort of a common nomenclature with ethers. So with ethers, they're named ethyl, methyl ether. With a common nomenclature, you just name the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And so this would be tertiary butyl methyl ether. And for simple ethers, you'll see them named that way, particularly, you know, the one that we use a lot in lab, which is diethyl ether. So those are the common nomenclatures. When you want to get into systematic, the way that we do a systematic nomenclature, if we have something that's a little bit more complicated, here what we do is we pick the longest carbon chain. And so that longest carbon chain is going to be this component here. We number it out, starting at the oxygen as carbon number one. You number out the longest direction. This then becomes a substituent on it. And this piece becomes a substituent. So these two pieces are substituents here. So what we have is we have a methoxy. So this group is the methoxy group. So that's on carbon number one. And on carbon number three, we have a methyl. So the name, as we put it together, becomes 1-methoxy. And then 3-methyl. And then it's named as a hydrocarbon, butane. And so systematically, the ether group is treated as a substituent on an alkane. And that's the way that we typically do those systematically. So for small things, we use a common nomenclature. For anything that's got any size to it, we treat it systematically and treat it as a alkoxy group, either a methoxy, ethoxy, or whatever the group is that's attached to the oxygen. We treat it as a as an oxygen substituent and then treat that as if it's on an alkane. And so in the systematic nomenclature like that, as a methoxy group, it has priority similar to a bromide as a substituent. It doesn't have its own functional group nomenclature or name ending root name. It doesn't have that component to it. Okay. With ethers, we always sort of go through some physical properties too. So when we look at physical properties, we can compare some similar sorts of materials. Ethanol, dimethyl ether, and propane. And we can look at the boiling points of these materials. So the boiling point of ethanol is 78 degrees Celsius. Dimethyl ether, the boiling point is minus 25. So it's a gas at room temperature. And for propane, its boiling point is minus 42. Also a gas at room temperature. And this one is a liquid with a boiling point of 78 degrees. So what is the difference between these materials and their very different boiling points? And what is the point that I want to make here? When you look at this, you know, we've got the oxygen that is connected to a hydrogen over here, and this type of material has hydrogen bonding. That hydrogen bonding of an alcohol allows it to have very strong intermolecular attractive forces. But when we go to diethyl ether, the only thing that it has is it's got a small dipole moment that sits in here. And so it's got small dipole-dipole forces. And you can see the effect that hydrogen bonding has versus the dipole-dipole force. The dipole-dipole force is just really weak as an intermolecular attractive force. So even though ethanol and dimethyl ether are structural isomers of one another, they have the exact same molecular formula, they have the exact same molar mass, they have very different boiling points because the dimethyl ether has such a weak intermolecular attractive force. And so while ethers are polar, they are not that polar. They are not polar to the extent that we would see for a ketone or an aldehyde. They're much less polar than most other functional groups. And you can see that when we compare it to propane, which has got London forces. We either call them London forces or we call them van der Waals forces or London dispersion forces. And you can see that the boiling point there at minus 42 degrees Celsius is a lot less than the dimethyl ether. But still, dimethyl ether is fairly nonpolar. I mean, it does not have a huge dipole moment. So ethers really are not that polar in terms of their polarity as a solvent. So that's the main thing that I like to hit with those, is just an understanding of the polarity of dimethyl ether or other ethers, diethyl ether, that while we think of it as a polar solvent, it's really not that polar a solvent. And that takes us to some common solvents. So common solvents that we might use in the lab: ether solvents, diethyl ether. We abbreviate it ET2O is the abbreviation. This one is tetrahydrofuran. And we abbreviate that one THF. So they pull the T, H, and the F. It's kind of an odd name, tetrahydrofuran. And it makes sense when you understand what furan is. Furan is an aromatic five-membered ring system. And so when you look at furan, furan has four hydrogens. And the formula for furan is C4H4O. Tetrahydrofuran doesn't have the double bonds. It has four more hydrogens than furan. Thus, the four more hydrogens is the tetra component. So it is C4H8O. And that tetra component is the four additional hydrogens, one on each carbon, in where it takes its name from. And then another common solvent, another common ether solvent, is the dioxane. So there's dioxane. And these solvents, I would say that of the solvents that are here, really commonly we use diethyl ether, we use tetrahydrofuran. Sometimes you'll see MTBE. And for a long while, MTBE was placed in automobile fuel. And so it was a component of fuel until we realized that MTBE was a pervasive chemical in the environment, that it found its way into groundwater and into reservoir systems, particularly with boating and the burning of gasoline in automobiles and boating. MTBE is a solvent that we use quite frequently. It's methyl tertiary butyl ether. And so there's the MTBE component in that solvent. So those are the four most common solvents that we see that are ether solvents that we would run into. All right, so what do we do with these things? Usefulness, what do we use ethers for? The main thing that we use ethers for is their ability to solubilize metals like magnesium. When we have magnesium and that magnesium is bound to some halogen, like a Grignard, ethers are used, ether solvents in particular are used because of their ability to donate electrons to the metal. And so what we find is that the ether solvents do what's called chelation. And that chelation is that they donate electron density to the metal to help stabilize the metal. It's like a hydrogen bond where an oxygen can donate electrons to a hydrogen in a hydrogen bond. But here, the oxygens are donating electrons to the metal itself. So this is what we call electron donors or ligands. A ligand is something that donates electrons to a metal. Let's say a molecule that donates electrons to a metal. And so ethers are extraordinarily good ligands for solubilizing metals in organic reactions, which is why we frequently use those ether solvents. So let me show you another little reaction here. If we take and try to do an SN2 reaction with potassium fluoride. And so what I'm attempting to do is to dissolve potassium, fluoride, and water, and to do a SN2 reaction. What I find is I get no reaction. If I take and I try to do this reaction in benzene, I get no reaction. So the idea there is, or the problem there is, that these two materials, water and the solvent here, are incompatible. So what winds up happening is you get two layers in the reaction. You get the water sitting down here and the potassium and the fluoride floating around as ions because they're soluble in the water. And then up top here, sitting on top of it, you get the hydrocarbon. And it's biphasic. And that means that there's no collisions between the fluoride and the bromopropane, or the one bromopropane. And so no reaction takes place. The problem in the other one is these two, that these two are not compatible. So here again, we get sort of a biphasic system where we get benzene and the substrate in solution. But what we get is we get potassium fluoride, which sits down here as a solid. And so the potassium fluoride doesn't go into solution. And so we could say that this one is kind of biphasic as well in a different way. Biphasic, and then I have a solid sitting down in the bottom of the reaction and no reaction takes place. So if I can't get these two into solution by using water, and I need water to solubilize the ionic component, and if I try to get the substrate in solvent, in benzene, then the potassium fluoride precipitates out. What is the winning solution here? Here's the winning solution. We take and react this with potassium fluoride in what's called 18 crown 6. And we do it in benzene. So now we need to understand what 18 crown 6 is. 18 crown 6 is an ether. It's what's called a crown ether. Oh, and by the way, this reaction now goes like a shot. So crown ethers look like this. This is what's called a 12 crown 4. So what do the numbers mean? The oxygens are the 4, and the 12 is the number of atoms that are around the ring system. So if I start counting here, this is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and finally 12. There's my 12 crown 6, or 12 crown 4. So a 12 crown 4 ether is a ring that is 12 atoms around. 4 of those are oxygens. If I want to look at an 18 crown 6, the way to draw an 18 crown 6 is to do it this way. And I find it a little bit easier to draw the patterns this way. I draw in the oxygens first, and then I draw in the rest of it. You can make it look a little bit prettier. This is an 18 ground 6. And notice that they're all ethylenes, that these are all derived from ethyl groups in the crown ethers. Okay, so what does the crown ether do then? What the crown ether does is it allows for metals to sit in the middle of the crown ether, and they chelate the metal, and different crown ethers will chelate different metals. So by chelating metals, the potassium, for instance, if we take and draw an 18 crown 6 one more time, what we find is that the metal fits inside the crown ether, and that the crown ethers use their electrons to donate electron density to the metal, and they hold the metal tight, and they fit around the metal. And the fluoride then is brought along with it, because wherever you take the cation, the fluoride has to follow. And now what happens is it takes this ionic thing and makes this ionic thing look organic. So this component here is organic soluble. And so what that means is that the whole thing becomes soluble in benzene. And once it becomes soluble in benzene, now the fluoride can do the SN2 reaction in that other example. So what we find is that with different metals, based on their sizes, we need different crown ethers to solubilize the different metals. So lithium being very tiny, lithium requires 12 crown 4. Move up to sodium, and the sodium requires a 15 crown 5. Move up to potassium, the larger one, and we're at 18 crown 6. And so you can drag in different cations into solution by using different crown ethers. Kind of a neat trick, actually.
And to look this up, you look in the CRC handbook?
CRC is one place to look. I think that what I would do in these days is I would just Google what crown ether is appropriate. But the two sources to look up things is Merck Index. Merck Index is generally a standard, and you could look up in the Merck Index, you could look up the metal, or you could look up the crown ether. The CRC is another textbook that has physical data and tables and all kinds of other things. There's one other place that I find that, while these two are sort of gold standards for information, for organic chemists, the book that I like is The Handbook of Organic Chemistry. Is that what it is? Handbook of Organic Chemistry? I don't have it with me. I might need to look up the title. It's called A Chemist's Companion. Let's do it that way. This book is super cool. It doesn't have as much physical data like a Merck Index or a CRC. It is about maybe a third of the size of most textbooks, but it's a larger format sort of book. And that Chemist Companion handbook has all kinds of different resources for running different types of reactions. It has things for chromatography. It has things for spectroscopy. It has things for running different chemical reactions, cooling baths, if you need cooling baths, different solvent systems for solubility. And it's just a tremendously, tremendously useful book for doing these types of things. And I'm sure that the crown ethers are explained in there at some point. So those are like three of my big top resources. And I would say that I go to the Merck Index and the Chemist Companion more than I go to the CRC. The CRC is really technical data. And and it's so dense and so difficult to use that I very rarely go to the CRC.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, reactions. Some of these are review. The first one is a Williamson ether synthesis. The Williamson ether synthesis takes an alcohol and reacts it, number one, with sodium hydride, and number two, with a primary alkyl halide. And this is inherently an SN2 reaction that we're doing that makes the ether. Let's say that that's R prime. That's where we end up with there. And so it's inherently an SN2 reaction, and it has the same restrictions as all SN2 reactions. So mechanism-wise, what happens is the sodium hydride is used as a nice clean way to deprotonate the ether or the alcohol. The hydride with the sodium counterion takes the proton and creates the alkoxide ion. Sodium's just a spectator, it's just sitting around, but H2 now goes off as a gas. To the alkoxide ion, we introduce the primary alkyl halide, and it's a simple SN2 reaction from there. That leads to the ether, and the sodium ion becomes the counterion for whatever the halogen is. And they usually precipitate out as a solid in the reaction mixture. So that's our Williamson ether synthesis. Now, when we do a Williamson like that, what this implies is that if we want to do retrosynthesis, let's think about retrosynthesis.
Can you scroll back up just a little bit?
Yeah, sorry, I was going a little fast. There.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's why I usually have something to drink on the table. It slows me down. I have to pause to drink, gives everybody a chance to catch up. When I start feeling thirsty, it means I'm talking too fast. Okay. Retrosynthesis. When we look at an ether and we want to make that ether, let's say R and R prime, there are two possible disconnects that I could look at disconnecting on that side, or I could look at disconnecting on this side. And so there's two ways to disconnect. The question of which way is the right way becomes interesting. So let's take an example and let's use MTBE as our example, methyl tertiary butyl ether. If we were going to disconnect methyl tertiary butyl ether, we could disconnect at that point or between the oxygen and the methyl group. So let's call the first one A. Let's call the second one B. So let's see if I have my colors in there that I can do switching easier. I'll do favorites later. All right, let's look at A. If I disconnected A, what that does is that gives me this piece and this piece. And so disconnecting at A would imply that I would need to put this back together by taking methanol, reacting it with sodium hydride, and then I would need to try to react that with tertiary butyl bromide to put it back together. If I disconnect at B, this implies that I have tertiary butoxide and a methyl cation. And that would imply that I'm putting this back together this way. I would start with tertiary butanol, I would react that with sodium hydride to make the potassium tert or the sodium tert butoxide. And then I would react that with methyl bromide to make the same ether. Now, sitting there and looking at these, one of these reactions works way better than the other. The question is, after you're finished drawing and caught up, look at it and figure out which one of these reactions is better than the other and why. And I'll give you a hint that the reaction key step is an SN2 step. So think about the reaction mechanisms as drawn, or the reaction sequences as drawn, and think about which one of these is better. So when you go through and you do the deprotonation, that's not an SN2 step. That step of the deprotonation, both of these work great. The problem is in the second step. It's in the SN2 step.
Wouldn't it be B because the CH3Br is a primary alkyl halide?
It is. Okay, that's outstanding. That is exactly right. So this is a primary alkyl halide. And as a primary alkyl halide, this is going to be the major product, right? And in a competing reaction, when we have competing reactions like this, the competing reaction of an SN2 reaction is an E2 reaction. Now, you can't do an elimination at a methyl bromide. There's nothing to eliminate. So there's no E2 component to look at. That is the major product that we wind up getting. But here, this thing would be minor. And the reason that it's minor is because what's going to happen is, rather than doing the SN2 reaction at the tertiary substrate, this guy is going to pull the proton, push that in, kick that out, and what's going to be major here is going to be the E2 product. The SN2 is what is the minor product. And so it's that competing E2 product that is the major component. That's where the problem comes in. And so absolutely, the better reaction is step B or disconnect B. And so we need to think about the sterics. This is all about sterics. And when we go through and we do a disconnect and we look at the two possible ways of disconnecting in order to put it back together, we need to be cognizant of the sterics of what we're doing and how those sterics are going to impact the chemical reaction. Right. And so I could ask you the same question again. I could give you another example now. What I could do is this one. And I could say, where do I want to disconnect? Do I want to disconnect here at A, or do I want to disconnect here at B? Where do I want to disconnect? Well, you want to disconnect where the oxygen stays attached to the sterically larger side, right? You want to disconnect where you have less sterics that's going to become the alkyl halide. So if you can't see it, then draw both. Take a second and draw both and say, all right, I could get oxygen minus there together with bromide. That would be, that's B. Let's draw A. A would be disconnecting and putting the bromide here and sticking with the O minus there. And so that weighs A, and this weighs B. So which one of those seems to be the better way to go? And really what you want to focus on is the alkyl halide. Look at the alkyl halide, decide if the alkyl halide is primary, secondary, or tertiary, and then make a decision. So what is the alkyl halide on the left? Primary, secondary, or tertiary on the left?
Primary.
Okay, so this guy over here is connected to a carbon that has two other carbons on it. So that would be what we call a secondary.
Sorry, I thought you were talking about the oxygen.
Yeah, not the oxygen. That's why I'm saying, I went back to highlighting. The oxygen is primary, but the oxygen is not what's important. It's really about the bromide. So we got to look at the bromide. So the bromide is secondary. The bromide on the other one is primary. And so we would go with the primary over secondary. This would be the correct way to go. Let's try another one. Something that looks similar. And again, we can do two different disconnects. We could do A, or we could do B. So A takes us this way. And this would be the bromide and the oxygen. And B would take us to that guy and the bromide.
So B, because it's more bulky, right?
Well, let's take a look at that. So this way is A, and this way is B. All right, rank the alkyl halides. Rank this part. Is it primary, secondary, or tertiary?
Well, that's a primary.
Yeah, good.
The other one's a secondary, so you want to take the other one then. You want to take... Yeah.
You want to go for the lower sterics on the alkyl halide. Lower sterics on the alkyl halide is what's critical. This is why I'm saying that even though these looked very similar and we went one direction on one, what we did is we followed the primary alkyl halide. we want to do the same thing on this side over here. We want to follow the primary alkyl halide or the lower degree alkyl halide. And so on this one, it would be route A that would be my more successful disconnect for putting it back together. Again, because it's about the sterics of the alkyl halide, not the oxygen. The oxygen can have as much sterics as it wants. What's important is the alkyl halide. To a degree. I mean, it's true. If you have a tertiary butoxide, that thing is a bulky base and tends to work more as a base than as a nucleophile. But as long as we keep the alkyl halide primary, it has a much better chance of successfully completing an SN2 reaction than it would otherwise. So that's that one. Let's, you guys all caught up? We're good? Okay. Let's look at a couple other quick ones. These are review. Alkoxy mercuration, demercuration. Although we didn't see them in this sense when we looked at this before, but what we could do is we could use one mercury acetate and then we come in with water and two sodium borohydride. So what this does is that this is what we remember. We were able to produce the alcohol in this. And the reason that we're producing the alcohol is this guy right here, the H2O, is where that OH is coming from. The water is the nucleophile in this. And the key step was that when we had the mercury, and the mercury had the positive charge, the water molecule came in and attacked the more substituted side, opening that up. And so that was my nucleophile. Well, what happens if I change this? This is what's kind of cool. What I can do is change the nucleophile. And instead of water, I can use an alcohol. Now, when I use an alcohol, what winds up happening is I wind up with not OH, but OR. And it does it by the exact same mechanism the ether comes in and opens up that mercury. And so, or the alcohol comes in. And so because that alcohol comes in, the proton gets removed and the R group remains and this becomes an ether. And so it's another common way that ethers are made are by using the alcohol with an alkene. And we can get a little bit creative in some of the ways that we can put these together. So two ways to make ethers, the Williamson, I guess I have it up here. So that's the Williamson ether synthesis. That's number one. And the second way is by alkoxy mercuration demercuration. Are the two ways that we've shown now. Ethers are fairly robust, but they do undergo some chemical reactions. Cleavage reactions. If we take an ether, we can react that ether with acid, strong acid, and heat, and we can break it apart. It becomes Rx plus R prime X plus H2O. And the way that that works is just a series of SN2 reactions. So if we look at the mechanism, and this isn't very synthetically useful. This isn't something that you would generally want to do. It's something you try to avoid most of the time more than anything. What happens is the first step is protonation. Once you've protonated the oxygen, you've created a good leaving group. And the halogen can then come in and do an SN2 reaction, knocking out the leaving group. So there's our first Rx. And the alcohol that we create. Then that guy goes on and gets protonated again. That creates another good leaving group. The halogen comes in and does an SN2 step again. And we get the two SN2. So there's your water molecule. And now here is R prime X. And so you can see just going through that, you can see the first part. You can see the second part. And the water molecule that gets created. And how that gets torn apart. So ethers are fairly robust though. This is very hard to do. It takes a long time and a lot of acid and a lot of heat in order to tear this apart, but it can be done. It can be torn apart through a series of chemical reactions. All right.
So they're not stable in strong acids.
I would say that they are stable in strong acids. They are stable in like 3 molar, 6 molar. But by the time you get to concentrated acids, or if you're in 6 molar and you add a ton of heat to it, then I would say it would start to tear it apart. So by hard, I mean, conditions here might be 6 molar H2SO4, 100 degrees C for like 4 hours, or possibly concentrated H2SO4, few minutes. So the conditions are fairly nasty conditions in order to tear apart an ether like this. It doesn't happen easily. And anything that you do to shred an ether is going to shred any other functional group that was in this molecule. So it's not like you can just target the ether and break apart the ether and not hurt the rest of the molecule. It's not synthetically useful. I think that's what I'm trying to say here, is that they're fairly robust and that it's possible to do, but it takes some strong conditions to do it. Okay, let's pick it up with the epoxides. And as I said, these are called oxiranes. Now I got the name spelled right. O-X-I-R-A-N-E-S. Oxirane. I'm going to change that up at the beginning. So oxirane was an older name for an epoxide. And it's still commonly used as an oxirane. Epoxides, when we name them, we don't do a lot of nomenclature with epoxides. I'll show you how we might name something. So I'm going to make this one symmetrical so I don't have to worry about what's on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. This one is 3-ethyl-2-methyl. Pentene. Oh God, I want to say that's ENE or ANE. Damn it. I think that's pentane, ANE. I'm going to go with 2,3-epoxy-pentane. Okay, so how did I name that? How did that shake out? There's my 3-ethyl. There's my 2-methyl. And as I go through and number it, this is carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's my main chain. And that's the pentane part. The 2 and the 3 are the locations where the oxygen is located. That's the epoxy part. So the 2 and the 3 are locating the epoxy component. So we have the substituents on the left, substituent on the right, and then the longest carbon chain that includes the oxirane. Again, I'm not going to test you on the nomenclature on epoxides, but it's nice just to see how that nomenclature works so that you have it and you've seen it before. Oxiranes, we've done the preparation. So this is all review in terms of preparation and a little bit new in terms of reactions, but you guys know that if we want to make an epoxide, that we use MCPBA. Oftentimes what they'll do is they'll say that this is just a peroxy acid. But MCPBA is a specific peroxy acid. It's metachloroperoxybenzoic acid. And it's very good at its job of making epoxides. So that's metachloroperoxybenzoic acid. And that's where MCPBA takes its name. This would go through and form the epoxide. Smoothly. The epoxidation is specific to the isomer that you start off with. So if you start off with a trans isomer, then when you go through and do MCPBA, it's a syn addition. And so you wind up with a specific isomer that one of the methyl groups is back and one of the methyl groups is forward. We end up with the trans epoxide. If you start off with a cis isomer, then because of the syn addition, we would end up with the cis isomer. And so you need to watch the stereochemistry and what you're starting with into how that actually works. Now we do have another way of making epoxides. So besides using MCPBA, there's some other sort of nifty tricks that we can do. So let's take a look at one of these other reactions. If we take the five-membered ring system with the double bond in it, we can use hyperbromous acid is one way to do this. Hyperbromous acid, if you remember what it does, is it goes through the cyclic bromonium ion and it does a anti-addition of the hydroxyl group and the bromide. If you then treat this with either sodium hydroxide as a base, or you could use sodium hydride as a base. We use some sort of base to deprotonate the oxygen. Once you deprotonate the oxygen, then it turns back around and does an SN2 reaction. So this is an SN2 step. Where it can form the epoxide. The interesting idea is what happens if we do this? Let's say that we take our trans isomer and we do one HOBR and two sodium hydride. Do I get cis or trans for the epoxide? What happens to the epoxide? So am I going to get that epoxide? Actually, that's the trans. Darn it. Let's make that the cis. Or am I going to get the trans? What am I going to get? How do I figure it out? What have I got to do? Got to step through it mechanism-wise. So what we do is we go through and we realize that when this, let's treat it as if it's flat. So there's the flat one. We got to go through the mechanism of adding in the HOBR first. When the bromine adds, the bromine adds from one face. And then when the hydroxyl group comes in, the hydroxyl group comes in and does an SN2 and opens this up. So this step is an SN2 step. The SN2 step, I'll try to be a little bit more clear about what's happening now, inverts the configuration of that first carbon. So the carbon, this carbon, just underwent inversion of configuration. Then what happens is the hydride pulls the proton. Creating the O minus. And that does a second SN2 reaction, kicking out the leaving group. And that's an SN2 step. So we get inversion again. I switched things someplace. All right, watch what I'm doing. Pay attention for a second. I switched it right here. Notice I had forward the methyl, and then I made the forward the hydrogen. That was an error. The hydrogen should be in back, the methyl should be forward. That error persisted right here. That error persisted in this part. This should have been the methyl, back should have been the hydrogen. Okay, so I swapped that. I swapped that. Now I'm back good with my methyl being forward on that carbon. That was really important because as I turn it over here and I invert it, the methyl stays forward. Just because it was forward here and I invert it doesn't mean it goes back. When I invert it, it stays forward. It's just on the other side of the carbon. So now look at the orientation of the two methyl groups. Just for clarity, if I just put in the two methyls, ignoring the hydrogens, why can I not get that to look the way I want it? I'm gonna try one more time.
So it remains the same as it was originally.
It does, because it underwent a double inversion. The first time, actually, let's change color. Maybe I could do it this way. This carbon got inverted the first time, and now we're doing a second inversion, and we're doing it on that carbon. And so both of the carbons got inverted, and because it was a double inversion, the stereochemistry was preserved. If it was just a single inversion, it would have been reversed, but because it's a double inversion, it puts the stereochemistry back the way that it was.
So if those are really large, that still happens. If there are large R groups on either side, it doesn't matter.
Large R groups on either side really don't matter much because this isn't a intermolecular reaction. This is an intramolecular reaction. And because it's intramolecular reactions happen much faster than intermolecular reactions, meaning that the oxygen anion may want to function as a base with another molecule, but it won't function as a base internally. Because it's working on an adjacent atom, it will knock that atom out in an SN2 reaction pretty much regardless of the amount of sterics that are here, or I should say at least it will tolerate more sterics than normal SN2 reactions because it's happening intramolecularly, which is kind of neat.
And this might be stupid, but it's a buckling, right? It's kind of like it's going from this way to that way.
It is.
Yeah, right, okay. And then the left carbon stays on the left side.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Okay.
So it's trans.
What's that? Travis, you're muted. Try again.
It's trans. The answer to the question is trans.
The answer to the question is that it stays trans. It started off trans And even though we went through and did it a different way, the product still stays trans. And so what that means is that just like MCPBA, you can't get around it. If you start off with a trans double bond, you're going to end up with a trans epoxide. If you start off with a cis double bond, you're going to end up with a cis epoxide, regardless of the mechanism, regardless of which way you make the epoxide. That's kind of the neat thing to think about. Let me go about 8 more minutes, and then I'm going to cut us off just a little bit early. And this topic that I want to do is not really 8 minutes worthy. I don't even know if I want to do this. This is one of the first reactions. I'm going to start it and then I'm going to finish it next week. I'm going to give you an idea. This is worth exploring. It's a really cool reaction. When we take and do an epoxidation, if I have a molecule which is going to give stereocenters, and I do MCPBA, the epoxidation can happen on the top face or on the bottom face. So the epoxide, the oxygen, can come from this face as the epoxide, or the oxygen can come from the bottom face. And because of that, what I wind up getting is I wind up getting plus minus. I wind up making an epoxide that has the stereochemistry that I expect here, but I get the plus isomer, and on the bottom, I get the minus isomer. So we write that we get plus minus. We just write one of them and then we write plus minus. So we write racemic. And the reason that that happens is because both faces are equal. So I have equal approach. One of the things that was recognized, and this is really the first time that we talk about a reaction that is like this, is that if we could create a difference in the two faces, that I could react with one face and not the other, that if I could change the sterics on one side of this molecule, then I could create a situation where the sterics are unequal and I wouldn't get racemic. I could actually get a specific enantiomer. This was recognized by a man named Sharpless. And Sharpless is at Scripps Institute. And Sharpless has a reaction name for him called the Sharpless epoxidation. And it's an enantioselective reaction. And what he does is he takes alcohols that have double bonds in them that look like this. And he uses a different oxidizing agent. He uses tertiary butyl peroxide, and titanium is his catalyst, and this is isopropoxide, and there are 4 of these isopropoxide groups, and then he uses something that we call a chiral auxiliary, and it's abbreviated DEET, D-E-T. And what happens is it reacts only on one face and not on the other face. It reacts on the top face only, where these guys are coming up, and this is the only isomer that it makes. If I draw this in a different way, the equivalent way of drawing it is to say that the oxygen group here, the alcohol comes forward, and the methyl group goes back, and not racemic. Single isomer only. And there's a model to show how it works. And the really cool thing is that if he turns this reaction around and uses a chiral auxiliary called minus DEET, then what happens is that the oxygen comes from the other face. And when the oxygen comes from the other face, it makes the other isomer. So it makes this guy. You say, wait a minute, those look the same. But if I turn it around and draw it the same as the one above, what I get is the methyl group here and the oxygen there, and I only get this one.
So what's that minus DEET?
So what's that minus DEET, and how does that DEET work? That DEET here is plus DEET. Plus DEET is made from a chiral molecule that we find quite frequently in nature called tartaric acid. And tartaric acid has a number of different oxygens on it. So this is tartaric acid, but what DEET is they make an ester out of it. They get rid of the protons and they put ethyl groups on here. So that's plus DEET. Minus DEET is the opposite enantiomer.
So with those, it's always kind of like a rabbit hole thing, and you always end up with, well, that comes from a chiral thing that we had before.
It comes from a natural system. It comes from tartaric acid from winemaking. And tartaric acid is naturally available enantiomerically pure because it's made by living bacteria. So this is tartaric acid. And what the DEET does is the DEET creates a chiral pocket. And the chiral pocket creates a difference in the top of the molecule versus the bottom of the molecule, allowing the peroxide to only come from one face. And so, as I was saying, there's a whole model that shows how we go through and do this. And I'm going to present the rest of that model, and I'm going to draw it for you and show you kind of how it works. But enantioselective synthesis, or enantioselective epoxidation, allows us to make only one isomer in terms of the epoxide, which then we can use that epoxide as a synthetic thing to go on and make other enantioselective molecules. It's a way of making a right-handed molecule versus a left-handed molecule and only making one of them and not having to resolve them or split them out. So super cool reaction. Okay, I've got a meeting that's coming up at 12:30. I'm expecting them to call my cell phone any second now. So I'm going to cut it here, and I'm going to cut it rather abruptly. But we'll come back on Monday, and I'll show you some more with this reaction. So same bad time, same bad channel, and I'll see you on Monday. All right.
Thanks.
Keep working on that exam. You guys are doing good work. Take care.